flooding strands hundreds of people in central Montana. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the last day candidates could file for office. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with a state health official about why Montanans are the least obese of all Americans. Local officials say swollen rivers and impassable roads have cut off hundreds of people from outside access in central Montana, with more rain and snow expected to further aggravate flooding. Musselshell County Emergency Services Director Jeff Gates said at least 500 people in rural communities southeast and southwest of Roundup were stranded, at least temporarily. Gates' plans are being crafted to ensure sufficient food and medical supplies are available to stranded residents. Along the Musselshell River in Roundup, about two dozen houses remain evacuated, with more evacuations possible if the water starts to rise. The National Weather Service says a storm system moving into the region will bring rain and wet snow through tomorrow morning. More than an inch of precipitation was forecast in some areas.
Though not as severe, flooding problems also continue in Ravalli County, south of Missoula. County Emergency Management Director Ron Nicholas says the problems have moved from the Florence area south to Darby.
We've got localized flooding going on in certain parts of the county. They're moving around a little bit from what we had last Thursday, Friday. Different parts of the valley are now reporting that their roads are having some problems, or there are ditches that are full and overflowing, that kind of problem.
Nicholas says the flooding is causing widespread damage to local infrastructure.
There are roads, both private and public, that are being affected by this all, and I couldn't put a cost number on any of it, but there's going to be significant road damage.
Nicholas says the forecast of cooler temperatures and less rain will hopefully bring some relief. Governor Steve Bullock has declared a flood emergency for Montana. This declaration allows Bullock to use state resources, mobilize the Montana National Guard, and expend funds for emergencies arising from the flooding. After heavy snowfall and warm temperatures, 30 Montana counties are now under a flood watch, warning, or advisory.
A rock slide that dumped a large boulder onto Campus Drive behind the University of Montana campus early this morning prompted officials to close Mount Sentinel to the public and to close most of the east side of the drive to parking for much of the day. Public Safety Director Marty Ludeman says the weather created the conditions that led to a large boulder tumbling over the retaining wall at the base of the mountain.
You know, the cold and, you know, the freezing cold, thaw, water, and rain, it has a tendency to make stuff move. So that's kind of what I think we're seeing happening here.
Conditions improved enough this afternoon that the M Trail on Mount Sentinel was reopened, as was most parking on the east side of Campus Drive. One small section remains closed to parking, but the drive itself is open to through traffic.
And in other news from around the state, the FBI has released the name of a 19-year-old man who was shot and killed by the tribal police officer on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation last week. Special Agent Bill Facer says Clay Spotted Bear died March 3rd. The agency says officers responded to a report of a man with a gun that evening. Officers found the man and shots were exchanged. Spotted Bear was dead upon arrival at the hospital. Officials have not said if any officers were injured. Facer said today that the shooting is still under investigation.
A 31-year-old man from Cookeville, Tennessee, died in a two-vehicle crash on Interstate 90 near Bozeman. The Montana Highway Patrol says the victim's car was speeding westbound at about 9 o'clock last Friday when it clipped the rear bumper of a pickup truck. The driver lost control of the car, which flipped in and out of the median, rolled onto the roadway, and slid onto the shoulder. The man's cause of death is still under investigation. His name is being withheld until family members are notified.
A man who fled the state after walking out of a police interview room has been returned to Bozeman to face charges that he assaulted and tried to rape his former girlfriend. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports 28-year-old Kevin A. Briggs was booked into the Gallatin County Jail this afternoon and is scheduled to make his initial appearance in justice court tomorrow. He faces charges of aggravated assault, attempted sexual intercourse without consent, assault on a peace officer, and escape. Briggs was arrested early on February 1st after his former girlfriend reported she believed he may have drugged her, tried to rape her, and strangled her when she resisted. Briggs walked out of the police station when no officers were watching him. He was arrested in Oregon on February 21st.
A former Butte man charged with killing his father more than 5 years ago made an initial appearance in justice court today. Adam Hatfield is charged with deliberate homicide in the 2008 death of 49-year-old Matt Hatfield. Authorities say they have forensic evidence to prove Adam Hatfield killed his father at a cabin south of Butte, but have not provided details. The 24-year-old Hatfield was arrested at a South Dakota convenience store on February 19th and was returned to Butte to face trial. The Montana Standard reports Hatfield's bail was set at $500,000. Hatfield appeared in court with public defender Walter Hennessy.
The candidates are in for the 2014 election season. Secretary of State Linda McCullough has officially closed the election filing period for this year's statewide and federal election. As of last count, dozens of candidates will be running for the Montana legislature. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says both Democrats and Republicans say they feel good about their chances.
Secretary of State Linda McCullough says the last day candidates can file for office has historically been a pretty busy one.
It used to be that this day all the parties were in here and all the press was in here all day long tracking who was filing.
But she says that's changed quite a bit since an online option for candidate filing started about 5 years ago. She says now close to 70% of those running for election do it that way. She also says the numbers of those filing are consistent with typical non-presidential year elections. So now the battle is on for who will control the U.S. Senate seat currently held by John Walsh, who will win the U.S. House seat being vacated by Congressman Steve Daines so he can run for that Senate seat. There are two spots on the Public Service Commission open, two Supreme Court justice seats, 9 district court judge spots, and there are 125 state legislative districts which will be decided this November. Lauren Caldwell is the director of the Montana Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. She says the party will have a candidate running in every single one of those districts.
We don't want to take a single seat for granted. We don't leave a single seat without a candidate. We don't want to leave a single Republican without a challenge or any voter without a choice.
Last legislative session, Democrats were the minority in both chambers of the legislature, facing a 39-61 deficit in the House and 21-29 split in the Senate against Republicans. Democrats believe majorities are within reach, however. House Minority Leader Helena Democrat Chuck Hunter says some of the party's priorities will be investing in early childhood education, improving the state's infrastructure, and passing an expansion to Medicaid. That's an optional portion of the federal Affordable Care Act. Medicaid expansion was killed last session.
Ultimately, the Republican numbers prevailed and we didn't get that done, but I would say that's key on our minds.
Over on the Republican side, Legislative Campaign Committee Chair Billings Republican Senator Ed Walker says a lot of candidates have ended up filing last minute who weren't even recruited by the party. He says that's great, even if the GOP does not have someone running in every race.
It was never our intention to have every seat filled. I think what we want to have is people aligned really ideologically with their district.
A big story this primary season has been an ongoing split between moderate and conservative Republican candidates. Moderates broke ranks with conservative leadership during the 2013 session to pass many of that session's most notable bills, like major overhauls of school funding and public employee retirement plans. Republicans have a lot more challengers in primary races than Democrats, and the Democrats say it shows a failure in GOP leadership. Senator Walker says it's just fine. This is something that's happening across the country.
There always has been an ideological conflict and debate that's going on within the party. We're the party of ideas.
Walker says the party wants to continue a focus on shrinking government and enhancing individual freedoms.
We want to see a government with a more limited scope in people's lives.
The filing deadline is only for candidates in the state's qualifying parties, which are the Democratic, Republican, and Libertarian parties. That's based on the number of candidates on the ballot in previous elections. Independents and other minor parties need to gather signatures to run. Those signatures have to be turned in for verification May 27th. The filing deadline for those candidates is June 2nd. The primary election is coming up June 3rd. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The Montana Secretary of State's office also has approved for signature gathering a proposed ballot initiative that would bar Montana from funding or enforcing the nation's health care law. The proposal by Bozeman attorney and State House candidate Matthew Manfortin also would prevent Montana from participating in a health insurance exchange and would prohibit the expansion of the state's Medicaid program. A separate proposed ballot measure would expand Medicaid, and Montana already participates in the Federal Health Insurance Exchange that is part of the Affordable Care Act. A Fiscal Review says Manfortin's proposal would save Montana about $1.9 billion in state revenue, but cost $4.75 billion in lost federal revenue over 5 years. Manfortin has until June 20th to collect 24,175 voter signatures to place it on November's ballot.
A 41-year-old Montanan has pleaded guilty to three federal charges for taking millions of dollars in down payments to build steel buildings and instead using the money for his personal benefit. The U.S. Attorney's Office alleged that between October 2010 and December 2011, Jonathan Lee Oliver of Missoula received $7.88 million from customers, mostly in Montana and North Dakota and South Dakota, but only completed one building. Prosecutors alleged he spent nearly $686,000 on a house, three new vehicles, a 42-foot motorhome, and two personal watercraft. He was also charged with making 17 withdrawals from his bank account in amounts just under $10,000 threshold at which banks are required to file a federal report. Oliver pleaded guilty on February 25th to wire fraud, money laundering, and structuring. Sentencing is set for June 20th.
Two transients have been charged for their alleged roles in a check cashing scheme that netted about $109,000 in Billings. The Billings Gazette reports James Daly and Christopher McKean made initial appearances in justice court last Thursday. Daly is charged with 12 counts of felony forgery by accountability, while McKean faces 3 counts. Daly's bail was set at $75,000 and McKean's at $20,000. They are scheduled to be arraigned tomorrow in district court. Court records say Daly and McKean were among at least 7 transients who received money for cashing forged paychecks created by several Georgia residents. Prosecutors say Daly continued cashing the checks after a detective told him it was illegal. Officers are searching for 4 other men whose names appear on some of the forged checks.
The co-chair of the Idaho State's Budget Committee says a bill asking for $2 million to kill Idaho wolves likely won't get half that much money. Republican Representative Maxine Bell of Jerome says the money is instead needed to pay for the Idaho Education Network broadband program. Bell co-chairs the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. Legal wrangling over a contract the state awarded for an education broadband project has cut off federal funds for the program. Bell tells the Times News that lawmakers have flexibility when it comes to killing wolves, but they don't with the Idaho Education Network. She says the fund to kill wolves will probably get about $400,000. Even if the proposed wolf control bill becomes law, the committee Bell co-chairs would determine the final funding amount.
A Hanford watchdog group is criticizing the federal government's plan to take at least 2 years to pump out a nuclear waste storage tank that is leaking. The group Hanford Challenge says that delay is too long. The U.S. Department of Energy on Friday presented the state of Washington with a plan for emptying the double-walled storage tank known as AY-102. The underground tank is located within the Hanford Reservation near Richland. The tank, the oldest of the giant double-walled tanks at Hanford, contains radioactive wastes left over from the production of plutonium for nuclear weapons. The plan says pumping would not begin until March 2016 at the earliest. Leaks have been found within the walls of the tank, but no waste is believed to have escaped into the ground.
For the 6th straight year, a firefighter from Missoula has won a stair-climbing competition in Seattle. Missoula City firefighter Andy Drobick won yesterday's Scott Firefighter Stair Climb for the 3rd straight year, posting a time of 11 minutes 5 seconds. Co-worker Benjamin Brunsvold was second in 11 minutes 34 seconds. Brunsvold finished 3rd last year. The Stair Climb, a fundraiser for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, requires firefighters to race up 69 flights of stairs in the Columbia Center in full combat gear. Missoula rural firefighter Corey Burgess won the event from 2009 to 2011. Miles City firefighter Sarah Young was 4th in the women's division, climbing the 1,311 steps in 16 minutes, 44 seconds. Gary O'Brien of Bozeman was 8th in the master's division for firefighters age 40 and over. He finished the climb in 14 minutes, 28 seconds.
A recent national Gallup poll lists Montana as the least obese state in the country. Only 19.6% of Montana's population is obese, the only state to come in under 20%. Nationally, more than one-third of adults are obese. Mississippi is the fattest state, with 36.4% of their population rated as obese. News Director Sally Mock spoke with the head of Montana's Nutrition and Physical Activity Program, Mandy Zanto, about some of the reasons why Montana is the least obese state in the country and how to get those numbers even lower.
You know, Montana's as a whole are pretty active, just as our state, with a lot of outdoor recreation. We can't conclude one factor to it, but there's a lot of, and we have a lot of statewide initiatives that are going on that help improve that also, starting with our early child care, school health, active community environments, to name a few.
And those programs that you just listed there, those have really been started in recent years, and they are making a difference, you're sure?
Well, they have started in recent years. I can't say, you know, for sure the evidence base, but we're, you know, they are newer programs, but we're starting to look at physical activity through all, you know, K through 12 is 0 through 5, as well as in our communities, and, you know, access to healthy fruits and vegetables at farmers markets, and looking at breastfeeding initiatives. It all kind of goes together to improve obesity and lower chronic conditions and disease in our state.
And in terms of school nutrition, that has changed a lot, not just in Montana, but around the country in recent years. It used to be pretty much not all that nutritious, but now schools are very much conscious of the kind of nutrition they're serving students.
Yeah, and the schools have to go by the dietary guidelines that at the federal level that they set. So with the new school lunch programs and all that, that comes down from the federal guidelines.
Do you think Montana also attracts people who may be fit to begin with? They move here because of the outdoor recreation opportunities we have. They want to hike and kayak and do all those kinds of things. Does that skew our statistics a little bit?
I don't know if it skews the statistics, but it definitely, you know, Montana does attract that outdoors, you know, the physical activity and the outdoor activity that we have here. So definitely people are coming to the state for those reasons.
The good news, of course, is that Montana ranks so high, but the bad news is still 1 in 5 Montanans are obese. It's just under 20%, which seems like a high number.
Yeah, I mean, and we all obviously are in the lower tier at that 19.6%, I think it was. But that also shows that we do have work to do, and that's what part of our jobs at the State Health Department entails, is working to get that even lower.
And what do you think remain the obstacles? Certainly there's a lot of discussion these days about how technology is making us all more sedentary as we become addicted to our smartphones and our computers and so on.
That could definitely contribute to it. We're spending a lot of time at our desks. Kids are spending a lot of time on their phones or playing video games. So, yeah, the technology can definitely have a factor with that.
And, of course, in terms of nutrition, there's a lot of studies about how people who have poor eating habits are often poor people, that they don't have either access to fresh food, like they live in food deserts. That would be true in some of the more urban areas in the country. But in Montana, do you think that's true, too? Do you think poverty plays a role in poor nutrition?
I can't say definitively yes. You know, I think as our nation as a whole, we are living and eating more more processed foods, and we're, you know, trying to reverse that by getting access to local farmers markets and more access to fresh fruits and vegetables. I know our, you know, the WIC program now has fresh fruit and vegetable vouchers, so I think that as a whole we need to start looking that way. But I don't know if just that one class, the poverty, has poor nutrition habits. They do have less access sometimes, but I think all of our state as a whole needs to look at eating more fresh fruits and vegetables and farm-grown foods.
It's a bit alarming to read in the same poll that nationally the obesity rates have gone up, which surprised me given how much attention and discussion has been paid to that in recent years. But still, on average, Americans as a whole are getting fatter.
Mm-hmm. And I think, especially in Montana, it's definitely plateauing and flatlining out. There's definitely a lot of work to be done in Montana and also across the country to get those down. So,
if you could wave a magic wand, what would you do to change it, to make the biggest difference, do you think?
There's so many factors that play into it. I think it's, you have to look at a whole wellness approach to combating obesity and chronic disease, and that is nutrition, that's physical activity. It's just the overall wellness approach to active living and healthy eating.
just being conscious of it and working at it. It's not necessarily going to come easy, right? That to eat healthy means you have to be thoughtful about what you're eating, and to exercise every day takes discipline.
It takes discipline. It's a whole lifestyle change. I mean, you have to look at it as a wellness approach to a lifestyle change, as opposed to there's not going to be one magic factor that's going to change it over time. It needs to be just an overall wellness approach.
And we still have a long way to go, but at least in Montana, we seem to be going in the right direction. So that's the good news.
That is the good news, for sure.
We have been speaking with Mandy Zanto, the Nutrition and Physical Activity Program for the state of Montana. Mandy, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And for tonight's forecast, west of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect from 7 p.m. this evening to 9 a.m. tomorrow above 5,000 feet for the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. There is also a winter weather advisory in effect until 9 a.m. tomorrow above 5,000 feet for the Butte and Blackfoot region. Tonight, rain and snow are likely with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with a chance of snow and patchy fog. Highs are in the 40s. For central Montana, there is a winter storm warning in effect until 3 a.m. tomorrow for Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, and Judith Basin and Marr counties. There is also a winter weather advisory in effect until 3 a.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. Tonight, expect snow and a chance of rain in the evening with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be sunny and highs 40 to 45 degrees. For southwest Montana, there is a winter storm warning and winter weather advisory in effect until 3 a.m. tomorrow for southwest Montana. Tonight, expect rain in the evening and snow through the night. Lows are 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 35 to 40 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
When Northwestern Energy announced last year that it had entered into an agreement to buy back the hydroelectric facilities that the Montana Power Company once owned, most Montanans probably smiled a little, thinking that a serious public policy mistake of the 1990s was about to be corrected. Those hydroelectric facilities had been the backbone of the Montana electric system since early in the 20th century and the source of Montana's low-cost electricity. Montana Power sold the hydroelectric dams off in a frenzy of fantasy in 1999 as it tried to get out of the newly deregulated electric power industry and become purely a telecommunications company. Within a couple of years, Montana Power and its new corporate form, Touch America, was bankrupt, and the hydroelectric generators were owned by a Pennsylvania utility, Pennsylvania Power and Light, which had gone the opposite direction in response to electric utility deregulation, buying up as many electric generating facilities as possible, no matter how far they were from PPL's home in eastern Pennsylvania. Montana Power's sale of all of its generating assets to an out-of-state corporation left Montana Power's old customers entirely dependent on electricity purchased on the Pacific Northwest regional electricity markets, at whatever price happened to be. The new utility that owned the wires that continued to deliver the electricity to Montana households and businesses, Northwestern Energy, had no generating resources of its own to meet its customers' needs. When electric prices in the Pacific Northwest electricity market were low, this was a good deal. When, as in most years between the year 2000 and 2010, market electric prices were high, that was not so good. Both household and business budgets were regularly disrupted by spikes in the cost of purchasing electricity. So getting those hydroelectric dams back and finishing the rebuilding of Northwestern Energy's portfolio of electricity resources may well have encouraged smiles from customers. But there was a not-so-small offsetting consideration, the price tag, almost $1 billion, $900 million to be exact. Imposing a financial obligation that high on Montana electric customers was bound to raise eyebrows and furrow brows. Part of this sticker shock is tied to the difference between a monthly rental payment and the cost of buying outright ownership. Monthly rent on a house is likely to be measured in hundreds of dollars, while purchasing the house may be measured in hundreds of thousands of dollars. But most of us still choose to buy a home. We all regularly have to compare costs spread over time to lump sum investment costs. We do it when we buy cars and homes or any time we buy something on credit. Fortunately, there are analytical tools available to us to help investors and consumers make such decisions. But there are also aspects of such decisions that are harder to quantify and then weigh. Some of them have to do with the uncertainty and risk. If Northwestern were to remain primarily an electricity buyer for us in the regional electric markets, we do not really know what that electricity will cost in the future, just as you might not know what your rent would be 5 or 10 years from now if you did not buy a house. Also, there are alternative ways to get electricity other than buying the hydroelectric plants. Northwestern could build a natural gas-fueled plant or buy ownership in some existing coal-fired generator. But then the future cost of operating those plants would be unknown. Natural gas prices have fluctuated widely over the last decade or so, and the cost of environmental controls on coal-fired plants have been rising steadily. Just as purchasing a house usually fixes your monthly payments off into the future, buying the hydroelectric plants that have no fuel costs largely freezes the cost of that electricity at current levels on into the future and removes a significant part of the uncertainty about future electricity costs. These are familiar types of risk against which consumers, investors regularly try to protect themselves by hedging against future price fluctuations in one way or another. That, like all insurance policies, costs something, but one can always ask the subjective question of whether the cost of that protection or insurance is worth the reduction in risk. But as with any business or investment decision, there are other aspects of the purchase of the Montana hydroelectric plants that are important and also have to be subjectively evaluated. These include the desire to repatriate the dams by having the electric utility that serves much of Montana control those electric assets subject to the oversight of an elected Montana Public Service Commission. Montanans built those dams and have operated and paid for them for over a century. The Montana electricity transmission and distribution systems were designed around them. The dams occupy our major rivers, providing a large supply of renewable and sustainable electric energy. They are here in our backyard, standing ready to serve our electricity needs, not located at some unknown place thousands of miles away. That hydroelectric generation flows not from a single huge plant, but from 11 different facilities, each of which in turn has multiple generators being turned by the falling water. They are also located across varied parts of Montana's geography so that they are not all tied to just one local microclimate. Clearly, there are a lot of positive features associated with these hydroelectric generators being dedicated once again to serving Montanans' needs. But then again, $900 million is a lot of dollars. It will be the Montana Public Service Commission's job to weigh both the advantages associated with once again regaining the control and use of these valuable energy resources, as well as the price tag associated with buying them back. This is clearly one of the more important decisions that the Montana Commission has ever been asked to make.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Connor tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.